The thrust outward then, is initiated by the logos and form succeeds form in phases of manifestation down the planes, the will of the logos which projects the forms, ensouling them with life. Now it is ever the aim of will to function unconditioned, just as it is ever the tendency of form to condition the unmanifest, and the will to live of the logos always entering upon the conditioning form, which, as it were, it pushes ahead of itself down the planes, is irked by the form, but in the later phases of the logoidal life unconditioned will is impossible, all action being determined by pre-existing conditions, and the will to live of the logos, which is the life of the manifested universe, has to submit to conditions and be bound in form. Hence the warfare between spirit and flesh. The life and will of the logos then, expresses itself through succeeding phases of form until the densest phase is reached. It can no further project the conditioning vehicle of its manifestation, and it strives to free itself from the bondage of form, and continue onwards to employ a metaphor of space towards those areas of the ether which have not been circumscribed and conditioned by the primal logoidal will. It is the endeavor of conditioned life to become unconditioned which forms the prime urge which projects it towards outer space. Secondly, there is the natural tendency towards equilibrium, and of the forces under high pressure within a manifested universe to diffuse themselves into the comparative vacuum of outer space. Thirdly, there is the picture of the penumbra, all those molds which are marred in the making, all those evolutionary concepts which fail in their realization, all misplaced forces and souls that have failed in their tasks, being rejected by their individuality, all that in fact, which it has desired to reject from the logoidal consciousness and which has been disintegrated against the inner shell of the ring pass not, remains as an image in the reflecting ether of space upon what may be figuratively termed the outer surface of the ring pass not immediately between that and the ring chaos of that universe, and there may be descried. Any consciousness then which ventures to the nether side of matter will discern across the great gulf, which is the ring pass not of the universe, the reflected images of all falsified helps and abortive attempts at manifestation, and these, as it were, craving for the force which should bring them into manifestation, call across the gulf to whatever elements are akin to them in that which presents itself at the barrier, and so it is that all evolving force, whether in the universe or in the individuality, having penetrated to fundamentals, looks across the great gulf fixed by cosmic law and sees the simulacra of its hopeless dreams promising fulfillment, and is tempted to continue forward on that path of outgoing upon which the divine momentum projected it, and by means of the further momentum acquired by its own motion to leap that gulf into the freedom of outer space where there is no law and men are as gods. For when a unit of consciousness escapes from a manifested universe by transcending law, because law is consummated in a perfect obedience, it becomes the nucleating center of a new logoidal sun. This is the mystery of Godhead. But when a unit of consciousness that has not mastered the law so escapes, it is an unconditioned will. This is the mystery of evil, personified as devil. This temptation of the nadir comes to all in the course of evolution. From the divine upon the outgoing arc, life has to penetrate into the fundamentals, and having touched the fundamentals, having attained the summit of its powers, it has to reject the temptation of the desire images reflected from outer space and retrace its steps in humility back to the source of its life, winning the realization that freedom is attained, not by escape from limitations and conditions, but by adjusting the balance to a perfect equilibrium. Equilibrium of conflicting forces, being attained, form is stereotyped and can be left to form the corresponding consciousness, and the ensouling life withdraws to a higher plane bearing with it the reaction capacity acquired on the lower plane, but no longer bound by the conditions of that plane. This will be dealt with more fully in the succeeding lecture. The attraction of outer space then, is the attraction of unconditioned power, it is the temptation to escape from the laws that have built us up, and to exercise the powers gained under these laws without the equivalent responsibility. This may be seen exemplified in the life of the man who, enjoying all the advantages of a highly developed culture, brings to them the aims and the ideals of an unevolved state of existence. The attraction of outer space is the temptation to break away from evolution and the cosmic law and to function as a god. Such gods are those who are propitiated in the rites of devil worship. Chapter 31. The Law of the Attraction of the Center. The Law of the Attraction of the Center contains the secret of the mystery of love. It may be considered under three aspects: firstly in relation to evolution, secondly in relation to initiation, and thirdly in relation to devolution and the left-hand path. 1. In relation to evolution. When a form of life has attained its utmost complexity of material organization, unification begins. This is obtained by means of synthesis upon a higher plane, and this having been secured, devolution of the physical form set in. This marks the transition through the nadir of the evolutionary arc. Let us elaborate this concept. Ideas of life expression, having been evolved by entities of a higher grade than the life forms under consideration, such ideas are projected upon these life forms in the etheric kingdom as they are approaching materialization, and in the malleable matter of the etheric type they are worked out, and this acts as a framework for the subsequent physical form. The life forces, compelled to circulate in the forms built in matter, develop a set of magnetic stresses. These having been developed, the material form can be discarded, and the system of magnetic stresses remains as an etheric mold. Thus does an inceptive idea pass through the plane of manifestation of matter and become a conceptive idea. There are many different devices employed for obtaining the same result, and though each of these owes its inception to a different inceptive idea, different attempt to work out a design, the conceptive idea of perfect adaptation is the same for all. So that which was multiplicity in its origin, by the perfection of its development arrived at unity. One is the symbol of the first manifest. Whatever reduces multiplicity to unity or a complex concrete to a simple abstract is approaching the center. The approach to the center is not a movement in space, but a unification. Now note the difference between unification and simplification, because this is the clue to much. Unification is achieved by evolution and simplification is achieved by devolution. Unification is the full synthesis, simplification is the ultimate analysis, or return to type. One is the advancement to completion, the other is a regression to the commencement. The concept of the return to the center might be considered as an extension of the center, for when return to the center takes place, the center is thereby extended, and we are taught that the return to the center is the goal of evolution. If this idea be meditated upon, it will be seen that such a return to the center should involve the extension of the center, for if all that is external becomes internal, the boundary must be extended. In very truth, it may be conceived that the return to the center means that the center is extended to the circumference and all things are as is the center. This implies the spiritualization of all the planes. Such a concept has two aspects, the form aspect and the force aspect. Force flows towards the center, withdrawing from the circumference. It therefore follows that the center, to accommodate it, must flow out. Thus it is the substance of each plane. Having had its native form withdrawn, is recast by the influences of the extending center into approximate forms to those which prevail upon the seventh plane. The withdrawing of force marks the end of a cosmic day and the beginning of a cosmic night. The outflowing of the center is the work of the cosmic night, and the secrets of the cosmic night have never been revealed before. The outflow of pure spirit over all planes of matter takes place during the cosmic night, and the archetypal forms remaining in the vicinity of the magnetic stresses are thereby galvanized, but they have no real life, having as yet no reincarnating principle, and therefore no memory. And at the end of the cosmic night, the spiritual tides withdraw, leaving the field to the emptiness of the cosmic dawn. But the forms over which the cosmic tide has flowed have been adjusted to cosmic stresses, and therefore all types of evil have been corrected. This is the cleansing of matter which takes place between each cosmic day and neutralizes the forces of inertia, and as the forces of inertia have their roots in the law of limitation, and the law of limitation has its roots in cosmic evil, you will see the significance of the work of the cosmic night, and you also see the deeper significance in the words "the powers of darkness." It is necessary, If you are to understand the deeper implications of occultism, that you should see that darkness leads through twilight into dawn, and day leads through twilight to darkness. Good and evil may be conceived of as areas of light and shadow through which a spinning ring evolved, and evil has its work to do as well as good. The God of light and the God of darkness are but the actions of the right and the left hand of the Father. The right hand gives and the left hand takes away. The right hand gives that which is to be, and the left takes away that which has been. The right sends out into manifestation and the left beckons back again, but you, looking as in a mirror, call right left, and left right. The attraction of the center takes place up the path of returning, and should that attraction set in prematurely, it causes the life to flow back to an earlier aspect. This involves a devolution of life before there is a devolution of form. When this returning flow takes place in relation to life, we see the development of parasitic types of existence. This explains the problem of bacterial disease. Other types of life which are saprophytic are not of this evolution at all, but are functioning under the dominion of the lords of the dark face, who are scavengers of the gods. It may be said, in parenthesis, that there are two types of bacterial disease, parasitic and saprophytic, which may occur independently or simultaneously. This is an idea which could be elaborated, but it will not be done now. You will perceive from the foregoing that a return to the center means a fading of a day of manifestation, and as the daylight fades, the spiritualizing darkness of the unmanifest flows over the fields of matter. And this must always be borne in mind in considering this problem. For as the light withdraws from the outer circuit of matter, so the spiritualizing influences begin to flow out from the innermost circuit of spirit, and this process continues until such time as all light be withdrawn, and the concentric circle of manifestation be completely overflowed with the cleansing waters of darkness. But meanwhile there is a transition stage during which the waters of darkness, which is a symbol of peace, cleansing and regeneration, make preparation for new life. These waters then are percolating through the planes of manifestation so that the seen will be interpenetrated by the unseen. This brings us to the second aspect of the subject of the attraction of the center, the question of initiation. 2. In relation to initiation. Those entities that have returned to the center at the conclusion of their evolution flow out again as the forerunners of the shadow of the spirit. It is these who are the initiators. They themselves have been enabled to progress in advance of evolution by being themselves initiated by developed entities of previous evolutions according to the planes on which they took initiation, the laws of each plane being the completed fruits of the evolution which had its culmination on that plane. These are the initiators of each evolution until those who are initiated, themselves having passed through the life, are proceeding outwards again. By the action of these entities, those who are initiated proceed from the surface to the substratum of their plane, and it is only when the waters of regeneration have penetrated through the cracks and fissures of receptive consciousness to a plane, that initiation can take place on that plane. Thus it is that at this stage the greater illumination can only take place out of the body, for in this phase of evolution the waters of regeneration have not yet reached the physical plane. 3. In relation to devolution. The attraction of the center has a third aspect in devolution, or the way of the left-hand path if applied to consciousness. In relation to evolution, devolution means the withdrawal of life from any given type of form, and the disintegration of these forms. The systems of magnetic stresses which life generated in them are then left as empty shells upon the etheric sub-planes. These shells should wait the cleansing of the waters of regeneration that flow out in the tide of the cosmic night. It sometimes happens, however, that souls which are sufficiently developed have reached the point when they feel the attraction of the center upon the path of returning, yet are insufficiently developed in certain aspects to be ready for evolution because they have not yet sufficiently undergone involution. These may set out to return to the center before they have passed the nadir. They will then be moving through planes from which the life has withdrawn and whereon lie the empty shells awaiting the coming of the tides of the cosmic night. These souls will then avail themselves of the systems of magnetic stresses of primitive types for the expression of their functions. This will explain much if meditated upon. When, however, these souls, having outworn and destroyed the shells, and thereby impeded subsequent evolution, continue on their devolutionary path. They reach a point where there are no more shells for their ensouling, and they will then be unable to maintain form, and will dissolve into the unorganized elements of substance and cease to be potent for evil or potential for good. That is the record of the left-hand path. Evolution by the right-hand path is accomplished through the withdrawal of the perfected life from the forms which separate, the synthesis of the principles which the forms were designed to express, the sublimation of the principles into ideals, and the realization of the ideals by cosmic consciousness. Such is the record of evolution upon the right-hand path. It will be seen then, that the essence of evolution is unification, and the manifestation of the unificatory principle upon the planes of manifestation is love. Whether that love be intellectual sympathy on the plane of the concrete mind, or physical unity on the plane of matter, love in all its aspects is the symbol of the Logos as one. The aim of evolution is to make all things one, and upon the plane of manifestation there are but two things which make all things one: death and love. Death is the manifestation of the left-hand path, and love is the manifestation of the right-hand path. Whoso loves, however dim may be his concept of love, is manifesting a unification, and unification is the goal of evolution. God is one. Love makes one, therefore it is truly said God is love. Whosoever expresses love brings spirit, which is one, into manifestation. To be loving is to be good. Whosoever expresses hate brings separateness into manifestation. To be separate is to be dead. Therefore choose love and live. Additional information: the additional material set out here has the same authority as the body of the work, but was communicated some years after it. While it has in many instances a specific reference to certain chapters, it is not here given with that reference to those chapters, since it is also a general reference to the teaching as a whole and provides a useful elucidation of the general matter in the book. Generally speaking, it refers more to the first 20 chapters of the work than to the later, but, of course, the more the book is understood as a whole, the more useful will the additional material be. 1. Each cosmic atom has within itself forces of two rays which set up the primal vortex, though later it went out along the path of one ray only. The two ray forces are the positive and negative factors in the vortex, the negative or latent representing a sort of subconsciousness. Examination of the ray type of an individual would call for sidereal astrology, a far more complicated and deep astrology than astrology is now practiced. 2. The Lords of Flame and the Lords of Mind do not meet upon the planes in the progress of the first three swarms, but there is a process at a later date whereby a Lord of Flame can, as it were, fuse with a Lord of Mind, thus becoming to all intents a Lord of Mind. The process is very difficult to describe. There takes place a kind of absorption, so to speak, somewhat comparable to the coalescence of an individuality with a highly developed personality in a human incarnation. Somewhat comparable but not the same. A Lord of Mind who chooses to carry on certain work for a Lord of Flame absorbs the experience of the Lord of Flame somewhat in the manner that an individuality absorbs the experience of a personality, but in this case the comparison is reversed, since the Lord of Mind corresponds to the personality absorbing the experience of a Lord of Flame corresponding to the individuality, and goes forth as a Lord of Mind with the far-off contact of a Lord of Flame, still working behind him. Many of the Lords of Flame are what we now call the archangelic forces. Others guide certain conditions in the universe and have a special contact with the solar logos. It is these latter which, so to speak, steep certain Lords of Mind in their experience and pass their influence into them, thus working through them. The Lords of Flame all have an especially strong logoidal contact, and some were what might be termed sent forth again after the first swarm had finished its work. It can be of special benefit to meditate on the three primal swarms, because that part of the book which deals with them was set down in a necessarily very approximate manner suited to the average intellect. It is important to bear in mind that all that I said is only an approximation, and far more than a merely intellectual appreciation can be gained through meditation on the first three swarm. The material in the cosmic doctrine is capable of immense expansion. Indeed, beyond the present limits of human understanding. 3. To try to put into comprehensible language and yet give something approaching an adequate delineation of the power and majesty of the three primal swarms is a difficult task indeed. The description given in the body of the work conveys little idea of the mighty work undertaken and performed by those swarms. Those great waves of cosmic life which built the laws governing the universe, evolution and man are of great importance at all times and especially at the inception of a new age. Their influence remains behind in man and the universe, and according as man is in touch with these primal beginnings when his own life spark first entered manifestation, even so is the type of his individuality determined. He cannot even now get away from those early stages of development because as his essential self took on the influences and reacted to them in the formative stage of his evolution, so does each human being at this stage still carry the latent consciousness of those primal actions and reactions. He carries eternally the seed of his own beginning, even as the oak carries eternally the acorn within it, and, as the acorn reacted to the soil in which it grew, as it received the air and the sun, in what measure its growth was made and it gradually cast off its outer shell and began to shoot and become an oak tree, so in a sense did man first begin to become man. As a man reacted to the various planes through which he passed in these primal stages of the life spark, and even then there was a measure, however small, of individual reaction, even so is that man today. As the spark came down the planes, gathered substance from each plane, and then returned up again, he met other sparks doing the same thing, and so again is it in his life today. In this mass of sparks on its first descent of the planes, there were some which formed a smaller mass within the whole, touching each other more than other sparks or groups of sparks in the whole. Thus did certain special reactions, friendships as it were, begin in the primal stages, and in later days of evolution those same sparks, clothed with matter of all planes passed through, again met those others equally clothed with matter of all planes passed through which had first contacted them in the primal stages. In passing through the planes, the matter or substance of each plane was interwoven into the inner vehicles of man and in time built the different forms or vehicles we know now by various names, e.g. the astral body, mental body, etc. And these bodies have also certain subdivisions. The great planetary spheres through which each atom and divine spark passed in the course of evolution also had a certain type of influence over it, and in a way this is the basis of astrology, though the roots of that study are largely lost and forgotten. Astrology cannot be applied nowadays as the ancient races conceived it because of change among the heavenly bodies, and man himself is changing also. In his passage down the planes, the evolving being came into contact with great planetary powers which still exercise some control over him, though he may not be aware of it, for he has matter within his makeup which retains a form of contact with those great planetary powers, and their influence on his body, mind, and karma still remains at very primitive levels. For example, the force described as the Great Mother still remains the Great Mother of all living beings, and the degree to which a modern man can consciously become aware of this contact is of importance to him. The great laws of the universe were made long before what we call man had evolved sufficiently to come down the planes in the same manner as had come down the great atoms and group forces which in the beginning built the universal powers. The group souls of these latter are behind what we call the great archetypes, and with these archetypes esoteric students can be much concerned. And as man eventually returns up the planes at the end of a chain of evolution, he reaches on another level his own beginnings. He becomes as it were a god, a type of logos, in himself at the end of many evolutions gathering together the great chains of experience which will have made himself no longer the individual but in a sense a group from which other units of mind force emanate. For man begins as a group and individualizes out of the group as evolution goes on, and in the end has to return to his own group which is then himself. Behind that teaching is the collective principle or collective sense which, partly or even wrongly understood as it often is, can be found in certain political ideals and systems. This sense has a high ethical basis and strives so to form the character that all should act as one, should act as a team and in a team, for it is the greatest, most intricate and first divine law when properly understood. Nevertheless, until the individual be developed to his highest, he cannot be part of the collective unit of divinity to which he should in the end return. And in each man is that which makes the Trinity, the three aspects of the manifesting Godhead, and these aspects are in his innermost spirit as its highest ethic. When this evolution will have finished, the experience and matter of this plane, Earth, will be garnered up and will pass on to other evolutions in other planets, and some of its life forces will return again in another guise to this planet again. When a man dies, portions of his astral and etheric bodies are probably lost for a while to his individuality, but also they often go to make up certain parts of the new astral and etheric bodies he will have in his new incarnation. That, in a few words, is what has happened all through evolution. Their form is broken up and the parts are carried on to build up the form of the next type of life form, but it is not always known that particles of the denser vehicles, not the physical, but the astral and etheric, the disintegrated astral and etheric bodies of people who have died, go to make up other personalities. These personalities may belong later to those individualities from whose former personalities the parts come, but it also happens that they may not, and individualities often have personalities composed of material which previously has been used in the vehicles of others. This sometimes can account for strange reactions between people in incarnation, so that it is not always necessary to look to meetings in previous lives to explain such reactions. As the human being is in this way, so, too, are planets and other heavenly bodies. Planets contain portions of other planets and of other cosmic times and other evolutions built into their auras, just as this Earth is in the aura of the Moon and has contact with many lunar particles of a former evolution. Life in its many-sidedness is not simple by any means. It is woven into a vast pattern which only very advanced in a plane adepti can realize, and there is no pattern that is not in some way linked with all the rest. 4. The planetary being evolves with the planet and corresponding plane. Its body is up to the full complement of 7 and its content of consciousness increased with the arrival and departure of the various swarms. The activities of the swarms for 7 were governed by the lords of the three primary swarms. Not until a planetary being had developed its full complement of bodies could it take a swarm through the full circuit of evolution, and not until then did the evolution begin of those sparks which became human beings as we understand the term. During the descent of the first 7 swarms, the influence of the Logos remained paramount in the universe, and any unbalance resulting from the epigenetic activities of the swarms 4-7 was immediately corrected so that the bodies of the planetary beings were not affected. After the full complement of 7 bodies has been acquired by the planetary being, however, the influence of the Logos does not fully correct any unbalance because influences from the now fully embodied planetary beings intervene. It is at this point that epigenetic factors lay the foundations of individual basic karma. Each planetary being is a stage behind the human evolution proceeding in its sphere, and thus acts as a drag upon it. 5. The three primary swarms can be aligned, through the Logos, with the three cosmic rings and with the essences of the four elements as follows. The present moon is not here referred to, the previous moon left behind its substance which goes to make up the aura of the Earth. This previous moon left much substance, too, for the present moon, and a great deal of its powers or influences are there, but many, too, of its primitive powers and certain very important factors remain within the Earth, in what esoterically is called the inner Earth, and both these are as well joined into one huge aura which is around both the present moon and the Earth. 1. The Lords of Flame with their great stresses of movement appertain to the ring Cosmos and to the element of fire. 2. The Lords of Form appertain to the ring Chaos and to the primal Earth, Water Essence, the elements of Earth and Water. 3. The Lords of Mind appertain to the ring Parsnot and to the element of Air. Individualism can reach a certain limit only and then is turned back onto a higher arc of collectivism. The limits of the human mind are a safeguard of the human race. 6. There will come a time when the planetary spheres no longer hold any swarms passing downwards on the arc of involution. When this occurs, the condition left behind by the last swarm will gradually dissolve and for a space nothing will happen. Then there will gradually come in a type of vortex from outside the plane, something that is seeking development, a kind of non-human being which will then go through an involution on a small scale on the empty plane.